Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Today, I want to talk about a book that's been around for a minute, or at least the conception of it has been around for a minute. But I think it takes on increasing importance. Increasing importance because as we see the consolidation of media all around the world, or at least around these parts of the world, and we see the consolidation of what is allowed to flourish online and what is allowed to be spoken about in classrooms. This book, Visualizing Palestine, A Chronicle of Colonialism and the Struggle for Liberation, which was already a powerful tool, becomes even more important. And this afternoon, I have two people that are involved with that project, Jessica Anderson, who is one of the editor, and Nod, who is one of the designers, is here with us this afternoon to talk about the concept of the book, which is very unique if we talk about what it means to collaborate and do things collectively. This is a shining example. And if we talk about changing a narrative or highlighting a narrative that has been erased, this is again is a shining example. So I want to welcome you both to the show. And I didn't want to say too much about the book because I think explaining it and the process of putting it together is just as important as actually having it in your hand. The thing, like we talk about the importance of reaching your goal, but I think this is an example of what the importance is, just as much as the journey to that goal. So let me start off with you, Jessica. Let's talk about this concept, how long it's been in motion and where it stands right now around this book.
Absolutely. Thank you, Davey D, so much for having us on the show. It's really wonderful to be here. So, the book Visualizing Palestine, A Chronicle of Colonialism and the Struggle for Liberation came out in September of 2024, so over a year ago now. But as you said, it's been the product of a long history of work. Visualizing Palestine is an organization and an initiative, and really, an idea. And the idea behind our work is, that we can create tools that support activists, educators, advocates to tell the story of Palestine, both to tell, the history of the Palestinian struggle and to understand the current status of it. So we've been working for over a decade as a team to create visuals like infographics, maps, and illustrated explainers on a wide variety of topics related to Palestine. So again, we've looked at history and the historical injustice Palestinians have experienced. We've unpacked key concepts that are important to the Palestinian struggle, like settler colonialism or apartheid, or the idea of ongoing Nakba and what that means. And we've covered water, ecological justice, children, reproductive justice, disability justice, freedom of expression. We've just kind of tried to come at the story from many different angles and build the ties between movements over the years. So when it came to this book, it was an opportunity to say, okay, we have hundreds of visuals that we've produced. There's over 160 contributors to this work over the years. If we were to bring it together into one collection that kind of reflects on a decade of this data storytelling work and brings out some of the overarching themes, what have we been trying to do? What is the narrative that we've been trying to get across piece by piece over the years? And so, with this book, we curated from our collection of hundreds of visuals, we curated 12 chapters that each touch on different themes. And each chapter opens with an essay to sort of put the visuals in context. And that was a multi-year process of putting the book together. And we actually were we were about to finalize it in October of 2023. And so at that point in time, we paused and we actually kind of reopened the process a little bit because we recognized that something so enormous was unfolding in the history of Palestine, with the start of the genocide, and we wanted to make sure that we addressed that as well in the book.
Yeah, I had to smile as you were talking on a number of fronts. One, when you talk about 160 contributors, and you being an editor, I'm like, wow, that's like herding cats for real, getting everybody's information and, in balancing what people are very passionate about and feel is absolutely important. So that's one thing. And then, my own experience when we did our book with Jeff Chang, seeing how you have a publishing date and then you look out the window and you go, Jesus Christ, things is moving and you just can't go with the publishing date. In our case, it was like we were ready to go. And then the pandemic hit and then George Floyd and the elections. And the next thing you know, we were like, no, we gotta move things back because it essential to what you're talking about in here, the same thing. But with all that being said, I'll ask you, and then I'll bring you in, Naz. You can only put so much in the book. And so what were you agonizing about that you had to leave out? Because I think almost anything that you have is important.
Yeah, I mean, actually, we were able to put in maybe, 9 out of 10 visuals that we've produced over the years. So it really is
Okay.
quite comprehensive in terms of what it includes from our archives. But I will say, infographics and sort of static visuals are only part of what Visualizing Palestine has published over the years. We've also done interactive work, and we've created research portals and platforms, and those are also included in the book, but it's almost like sort of acknowledging that they exist rather than fully unpacking everything that they those platforms hold, because obviously the book is, it can't show everything that an interactive or sort of like a multimedia platform might hold. So there were some limitations there, and I felt like there was so much we wanted to show in terms of how the work has been used in different contexts, but it was really hard to get, photo permissions for, like, we've collected photos over the years of people using the work, and sometimes it's hard to keep track of where did this photo come from and who actually has the rights to it. And so I wish that we could have shown more of that. We tried to do what we could on that front as well. And then the final thing I'll say is just whenever you're working with data and information, obviously it's like it's constantly evolving and changing. And so it's always hard to freeze something in time with a
Right.
publication like a book, because it is an ongoing story. And especially at the time that we published it, with the genocide unfolding, we knew that, we were working at a pace that was, kind of faster than ever, trying to cover everything that was happening. And we knew that we were going to have to draw the line somewhere to say, we're going to publish this book, and yet there's going to be so much more to come in this story.
Right.
And hopefully people will come to our website, where we're always publishing new information, and kind of see how that's evolved.
So it's interactive in that way. It's a constant conversation, and a very important one. Naz, you're a designer, among other things. So talk a little bit about your contributions to this effort and some things that stand out for you.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to be able to, join the Visualizing Palestine team pretty soon after I graduated from college. And that's where I first experienced and encountered Visualizing Palestine's tools. I was, a student organizer. I was in, my school's SJP, and Visualizing Palestine was sort of the default place we would go to look for visual resources when we were doing political education events or teach-ins or tabling, or just trying to do that general peer-to-peer consciousness raising advocacy for divestment campaigns that, is common to so many campuses, for years before October 7th, but of course after as well. So that was sort of my introduction. And I think, the work poses like a really interesting challenge as a designer, in a number of ways, and especially since the start of the genocide in Gaza.
because so much of what we're trying to do in our work is to take things away from the headlines or what people might see, just on their social media feeds, and to put it really within the deep context of, what Rashid Khalidi calls the 100 years war on Palestine. So to understand what's happening in Gaza now, not just in terms of what's happened since October 7th, 2023, but to also put it within the context of, 17 years of a suffocating blockade on Gaza that preceded this genocide, 57 years of a brutal military occupation, 77 years since the Nakba, the period in time where Palestinians were mass dispossessed and ethnically cleansed from their homeland. And as a designer, that poses a lot of challenges because on the one hand, a lot of times you're trying to work with very large numbers, particularly since the genocide. Obviously, we've seen, the death tolls mounting, it almost being impossible to describe the level of destruction. And when you're trying to mobilize people, when you're trying to create, resources that can make people feel engaged and that they can do something about this, numbers and data visualization can actually sometimes have this counterintuitive effect of being somewhat numbing. You just see this sort of, these numbers climbing, but the human element of it gets lost when you're talking about 10,000 kids. What does that even mean when you're talking about 60,000 people, when you're talking about, 200,000 people, when you're talking about 2 million people being displaced? What does it mean to be, for the entire population of Gaza to be, facing this kind of internal displacement? So that's like one challenge we encounter is how to bring the humanization to the data, how to bring those actual storytelling elements. When are we balancing sort of the rigor of, accurate data that we want to visualize and communicate to people with individual stories that can really humanize that data and make talking about clear? And at the same time, like Jess said, a lot of what we also want to communicate to people is not just sort of the data itself or the research itself that we either collect or work with organizations to collect, but also the conceptual way to understand that data. So, the way that the book is organized is into these concepts like apartheid, settler colonialism, ecological justice, prisoners. And for us, it was also, really important for people to understand, like, it's not just about understanding how this map has changed over time, but how these more abstract concepts, something like colonialism, can really affect what you think the political solution should be. So, as a designer, it's sort of balancing those aspects of the work, working with large, almost inhumane, kind of sets of numbers, and then also trying to communicate in a visual way, kind of abstract concepts, and make them cool. So a lot of our work comes in that, like, in between of how do we do that?
As I'm reading the book, looking at the book, because you're doing both, it's not just a read, but you're actually looking at these things. The first thing that came to mind is wanting to separate the illustrations that you have from the dismissive term that people like to use and say this is a meme culture we live in. Yeah, they're memes, but these are more than just memes. These are well thought out and they're compelling, which comes to the other thing, because balancing this information, which is in many ways is rooted in tragic situations, is a challenge. You're reading it, you don't want to be overwhelmed. At the same time, I feel like, wow, this is a tool that I can use because it's countering these arguments. But you all did it in such a way that it's not lost in text, so to speak. It's like you can get it when you look at it, which I think is something to hang your hat on. That's not an easy thing to do. And I'm just, I'm wondering what went on in the back rooms when y'all were putting this together. How did you figure out this would be a compelling graphic? And I'll give you one that really stands out. It's like the way y'all broke down the concept of apartheid, just looking at the various illustrations of that. That's like, oh, I can use that. I could use that. Oh, finally, somebody's able to capture what I wanted to say. And then you're looking and saying, wow, this is really brilliant in the way in which you did. So, did you have a test audience for this? Did you run some things to get a response? And then let me just close with this, not to be too long-winded. It's almost like the opposition has read your book and looked and said, yep, we are going to try and ban the use of saying settler colonialism. Political prisoners, there's no political prisoners in Israel. We're going to ban that. Let's get a law passed so you can't, call us an apartheid state. It's literally like I'm looking at this and saying, wow, everything they have in this book, there's literally some sort of law or legislation or some sort of attempt to ban of the usage of those words. And now we see, because so many of these visuals have been online, let's just change the algorithms altogether. And you know what? We'll just buy TikTok and get rid of all this. So any one of you can jump into that, but that seems to be the frontline battle right now.
Yeah, I think so much of it is really a narrative battle, and so much of what we've seen in the past 2 years, especially in terms of criminalization of dissent, has to do with that, with trying to sort of to reassert that kind of control over what sort of media ecosystem people are exposed to, and what sort of stories that they're hearing. And I think that's what made the genocide in Gaza, such a such a watershed moment for so many people, because for the first time they were seeing, this kind of unabashed, uncensored brutality live streamed to their phones. And, that in of itself isn't necessarily motivating, to people to do something about it. I think a lot of times people can feel kind of despairing and hopeless. So part of the intervention we're trying to make is to help people understand the root historical context, but also what they can do about it, how they can challenge state and corporate complicity by understanding it, understanding how it works, and understanding that the genocide itself and also the kind of 100 years of settler colonialism that preceded it isn't just about, attacking the physical presence of Palestinians on their land, for example, but also it being a colonial process as an attack on memory, identity, and stories. So, narratives are such a huge part of it, that the way that, Israel and the US sort of sustain the brute force of domination and warfare is through these narratives that are used to justify and perpetuate these same systems of domination. And so that's kind of what our core ethos is at VP, is to use data and research and graphic design to visually communicate Palestinian experiences so that we can bring, these narrative changes to people and play a role in turning the tide from, one of oppression to one that's oriented towards justice.
That's the voice of Nas. We also have Jessica here from the Collect Visualizing Palestine. Jessica, is there any particular visual that you all have had in the book that you saw really had an impact in terms of changing minds and swaying opinions? I mean, there's so many of them, but for a long, long time, there's been this dominant narrative, this Zionist narrative, that has either one, erased Palestinians, or two, demonized them to be, terrorists and the evil Arabs that are here to destroy the world, that type of narrative. And so there's a lot of ground to cover and a lot of myth to bust. But is there anything that stood out to you all over the years that you said, yeah, this was a turning of the corner?
Yeah, I can say, I mean, there's so many visuals I would love to talk about in our collection. I think, you could talk about hunger strikes, which is the visual we launched with in 2012, and kind of how that sort of put forward a model of a new way of telling the story that brings together research and data and design and sort of condenses it into one piece of work. So I think one that stands out to me, and that's one of our most widely used visuals, is a visual called Six Wars Old, 16 Years of Childhood in Gaza. That's one of our most downloaded and widely used visuals, and it actually started in 2021 as 4 Wars Old, 14 Years of Childhood in Gaza. We created it, NASA and I actually collaborated together on this visual. We created it in response to the 2021 Israeli assault on Gaza. And what we wanted to really capture was what it's like to grow up as a child in Gaza and what has every child lived through in their time. And to actually also take the focus away, because so often when Palestine reaches the headlines and when Gaza reaches the headlines, there's a focus on death toll in particular, and people don't talk about what are the conditions for people that are still living there, for the children that weren't killed. And there was a story in the New York Times by the Palestinian poet and professor Rifat El-Arir, who has since been assassinated, talking about his child being 2 wars old in Gaza time. So that phrase we saw immediately lent itself to a visual exploration of what childhood is in this
Right.
context. And then we've updated that over the years to continue kind of capturing these chapters, and especially because Gaza is one of the youngest populations in the world. There's almost 1 million children that are living through everything that's going on today and that are kind of inheriting the accumulation of history that is conditions in the Gaza Strip. So we really wanted to capture that through the eyes of sort of like a child growing up.
The thing that I thought was really illuminating for me was looking at the graphics you had of comparing Israelis versus Palestine with, foreign born, though that live in Jerusalem and all these different places. And the reason why is that I often hear, when you're watching the mainstream news, they're like, if you go to Israel, you'll see that. We're a diverse society, and Palestinians live right alongside Israelis. And in fact, there's folks that come online and they'll jump into these message boards and discussions, and be like, "If that's how you feel, give me a call, and I'll pay for your trip to come to Israel, and then you can see for yourself." And so that became a very powerful narrative, like, maybe things are kind of equal. But then you kind of shatter that myth with those detailed graphics. And I'm like, oh, this really is apartheid, in every sense of the word. And I think that those powerful tools, I think, are helpful for those who want to see justice. But it has to be angering folks to the point that, as I said, and I want you all to comment. Okay, we can't change the narrative. Why don't we get Larry Ellison to buy TikTok, and then we'll control it that way and shut it down? So we're already seeing a lot of activists being shut down. We're already seeing the shadow banning and outright removal of graphics. In fact, I think it's somebody was talking about some sort of policy that might be coming down the pipe where Israel becomes an American colony and. You're going to see more involvement. And it was very detailed. And I went to go share the story, and it won't share. It's like you come back and it's like been removed. And so I bring all this up to ask two things. One, what has the challenge been at this date and time with the algorithm suppressing these type of information, with people literally going up to, the legislature, including here in California, and saying, we don't want these books in the classroom. We don't want these visuals. In fact, it's probably these visuals that caught the ear that said, let's get rid of ethnic studies. So how are you seeing the lay of the land, and where has it been most challenging, and where has it been most hopeful?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think, when I think about the role of social media in changing perception of Palestine, I always think back on kind of the role the television played in people's perceptions of what was happening in Vietnam. And people have described Gaza as the first live streamed genocide. To some extent, I feel like the cat is out of the bag. People have seen and they can't unsee. And there was a really, interesting a recent clip that went viral of speaker at the Jewish Federations of North America annual conference recently, Sarah Hurwitz. She was saying that we, referring to, the Zionist movement, can't have a conversation with younger Jews because anything we say to them, they're hearing it through a wall of carnage. And at another event she spoke, she said, "I'm speaking through a wall of dead children." And her proposed solution to that was that no child should own a smartphone until senior year. So I think that, a lot of this repression that we're seeing is backlash against the fact that, the message has broken through. It's mainstream. The majority of Americans believe what's happening is a genocide, would support policies to reduce or end US military aid for Israel. There's a huge generational gap emerging around opinions toward US policy toward Israel as well as Israeli policy. So things have shifted dramatically, and I think that a lot of the repression comes from trying to like undo that progress. And I think, they won't be totally successful. That's where I get my hope from, is I feel like people have seen what they've seen in Gaza, that we're in this moment where people are, I think, deeply dissatisfied with the politics of the United States and are kind of looking at all the connections between issues and movements. And so even though we are facing censorship, we are facing repression, we are facing criminalization, we are also a much more powerful voice than ever before, and much more organized, and we're very determined to keep building on that momentum.
Right. Nath, how about you? I mean, we already mentioned the six wars old visuals. Are there other things that, maybe surprised you that really stood out for folks, that you're like, okay, we got to continue down this road or enhance it or take it to some other level?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was a student organizer, the one I found so almost like jarring to me, even though, I grew up, I'm Palestinian, like I sort of had like a bit of like background, knowledge of like people's, history and condition, but there's still so much that, at that time I realized I didn't understand. And visuals, like we have this Visualizing Palestine 101 series, which is basically supposed to give kind of a basic overview, the 101 of, if you're trying to teach about Palestine to a new audience, like here's some of the essential concepts about the historical context, about, the situation of apartheid. And there was one visual within that series that is about like nationality and citizenship, and basically visualizes the tiered identity card system.
Oh,
If
yeah.
you're Jewish, if you are a Palestinian with Israeli citizenship, if you are Palestinian with East Jerusalem residency, if you're a West Banker, if you're from Gaza. And I think it both shows so clearly this kind of separate and unequal system of, you only have national rights and citizenship rights if you're a Jewish Israeli, and then, you have different tiers of citizenship if you're a Palestinian, but all of them are living under different legal, political, and military regimes under, Israeli rule. And I thought it was just such a clear way to visualize this fragmentation, which is just such a core condition of the Palestinian experience, and not even the Palestinians that, still live in exile, live in the diaspora, are living as refugees in countries outside of their historic homeland. And I think visuals like that often really resonate with people because it's one thing to sort of kind of understand something conceptually, but then when you see it visualized so clearly, I personally find that like a really almost it makes me feel more like I have more power and more agency to do something about it when I really understand what's happening. And to use a more specific example that's, from a more recent visual, we worked with some researchers and activists to develop a visual about jet fuel shipments to Israel. And I think a lot of people don't know that basically all of the jet fuel that Israel uses for its fighter jet fleet comes from one company, one energy company based in Texas. It leaves from Corpus Christi, and these tanker ships go through the Mediterranean, and activists have tried to, disrupt these shipments by doing protests at the ports, all across the Mediterranean. And I think for, a lot of people, like, that's where you have to begin, is like understanding that this isn't just a genocide that is sort of happening in the abstract, or that, this abstract idea that the US sends weapons to Israel. It's actually like, no, this is the thing that happens in specific cities and specific ports. It's specific weapons that come from specific manufacturers, that go through
Right.
specific routes. And visualizing that for people, really making clear that kind of corporate complicity, what companies are involved, that state complicity, what states are involved. I think that gives people, the jumping off point for understanding, where are the weak points in the system? Where can we intervene
Right.
as movement to do something, to disrupt what our own government won't stop, which is, this sort of unconditional support for Israel as it commits this genocide.
No, that's real talk, and very important that the card situation of showing the different ID cards is powerful, and also the corporate involvement. I was going to ask about that. Looking at that, you all call out some key ones, Airbnb and all that. How impactful has that been? And do you have to quickly update it, because now everybody's talking about the involvement of Spotify? And I'm seeing more and more artists, point out, oh, Spotify is a big supporter of this. So that's that living thing. And who knows what we'll find out tomorrow. I imagine you have to put that on the website, or do you have to go, you know what, let's put out another book, as more and more corporations are capitulating and then winding up supporting. In fact, you might have to do another chapter. The capitulation chapter. That's my wish list of all the universities and people that went and kissed the ring and decided, we'll go along to get along type of deal. But any thoughts on that?
Yeah,
You know, just
we
with the
have.
corporations.
Yeah, we have. We've done a lot of work within the context of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which focuses a lot on corporate complicity, and especially targeting some of the most, like the biggest offenders. But it's a growing list, as you said. There's so much work to be done, and we have a long backlog of topics that we want to work on that we're working our way through. But one of the ways that we often prioritize is when we are able to work with a group that's developing a campaign, like a specific campaign. And that's oftentimes where we feel like we can add value, is in working with a group of people to help convey their message and to give them a tool that they can use to communicate with the general public about why is there a campaign, for example, Spotify, why Spotify? From what I know, Spotify has been running ads,
For
recruiting.
ice, yeah.
Yes,
Yeah, for
exactly.
ice, yeah.
So yeah, so for people to understand why does it make sense to boycott and what's the potential impact of boycotts, that to understand that this can be a really powerful and effective tool, and one of the actually the easier ways that we as individuals can, use our power to kind of choose where we give our attention, our dollars, et cetera. So yeah, we're always there's a definite need, so many topics to cover in corporate complicity, especially in this moment where it's about, accountability and how do you continue to call out those who have been complicit in this genocide, who have profited off of this genocide, and also who show up again and again in different contexts. So you're talking about ICE, like, we see again and again how there are the forces of repression, show up in all different contexts here in the US as well as in Palestine. So making those connections too, I think, is really important.
If we close out, a lot of what I've saw and read really focuses on, the calamity, if you will, that we're experiencing and hearing about, and narratives to shed light on that are important. How do we, how have you all kind of highlighted the wholeness of Palestinians, you know, so we don't see them collectively as perpetual victims, but also like, you know, these are folks that are really not only fighting back, but historically and presently have lots to offer. There's brilliance, there's collective wisdom, there's all these other things that they as a group contribute to. And how have you all been able to bring that to the forefront? Is that something that we'll find in the book? Is that something that needs to come later? To me, that's an important narrative as well.
Yeah.
Naz, how have you seen it?
Yeah, I think in a lot of our projects, this is a really important, aspect of the Palestinian struggle for us to highlight is not just sort of the conditions of oppression, apartheid, colonialism, but also the ways that Palestinians have always resisted it. And I think when it comes to communicating that to a wide audience, sometimes it can be like a bit counterintuitive what people find compelling. Giving someone a statistic that's, this many thousands of people, experience like this, thing might be less emotionally affecting than focusing in on like the story of like a single person. And I think oftentimes, the ways that people find like into a story is also something that we think about a lot. For example, we did one visual that highlighted the condition that pregnant women were facing, under the conditions of genocide in Gaza. And for a lot of people, like that's an experience that they can relate to. Maybe they've been pregnant, maybe they've had kids, and so that suddenly creates this kind of like new level of understanding between, oh, this isn't just sort of an abstract genocide that people are experiencing. This is a very specific, way that I can relate to, being in that position. Like, oh, if I didn't have access to healthcare when I was going through, my pregnancy, what would that have looked like for me? How profoundly life-changing would that have been? And at the same time, we also try to highlight the ways that Palestinians have used their ingenuity, their yet like you said, collective wisdom, to preserve their traditions, to preserve their communities and culture. And so in projects that highlight, for example, Palestinian food sovereignty, we both are trying to highlight the ways that Israel has, tried to attack the ways that Palestinians have to sustain themselves and, be self-sufficient when it comes to agriculture or producing food. But we also wanted to highlight the food culture itself, and the sort of hundreds of years of, handed down like heirloom,
Right.
techniques and seeds and stuff like this. So I think that that's, one way that we try to sort of bring in the wholeness of Palestinian humanity. And I think another part of being movement oriented, so I think back to also what you were saying about the algorithm, I think part of the way that we try to circumvent that is to not, completely rely on the algorithm for getting our stuff out there and, viewing our visuals as not just these things that we want to like throw out into the world, but as tools that we want to put in the hands of the right people. So a lot of our
Right.
work actually comes out of this relationship building of people who sort of recognize the fullness of Palestinian humanity and resistance and resilience, and putting our tools like into their hands to be able to use for their own, advocacy and mass movement building.
Naz, we appreciate you taking time out this afternoon. Tell everybody your last name and how we can get a hold of you, and then let me talk to Jessica to close out.
My name is Naz Abdelal. I'm information designer at Visualizing Palestine, and I can be found at nazreen@visualizingimpact.org.
Thank you. Jessica, as we close out, question for you is, in the beginning of the book, you talked about the hunger strike, and forgive me for not being able to, I know, I see the name, but I can't remember, but he passed, you know, with the
Kader
hunger.
Adnan, yeah.
Thank you. It reminded me of the quote that Dr. King said, I think at one point, it's like, you can't bring morality to people who have no moral compass, you know? And it's like, you know, great, did a hunger strike. And to me, it's almost like you have this cruelty that seems to be in the center of how a lot of these Zionist folks, operate. It's like, yeah, hunger strike, this is great. And so you're not appealing to them is the point that I'm getting at. They're not going to change their minds and hearts. But we also know over the years that the biggest fear that slave owners had was, the resistance, knowing that there would be revolts and all that, et cetera, et cetera. So with that being said, two questions. One, in any way, shape, or form, are you trying to appeal to the Zionist, crowd, so to speak? Have you been effective in reaching them? And if not, then do you very intentionally put things there that are going to make them, be like, damn, we have to really worry about this the way that we know that slave owners had to sleep with one eye open and with constant fear of revolt. So that's kind of how I'm looking at these tools as well. Or do you just completely ignore them and make sure that folks who want liberation for Palestine have them in the hell with what they think?
That's a great question. Yeah, I would say we mostly don't speak directly to Zionist audiences. We kind of see our narrative change work in terms of like who is persuadable, whose opinion can be changed, who can we move in a who is open to being moved in a different direction or to being to plugging in that, to being mobilized or plugging in a way that they haven't plugged in before. So I think in a sense, it's not that I don't believe that somebody who is Zionist can eventually change their mind. I think there's a lot of stories, especially with young people who have kind of grown up being taught a certain thing about Israel and what it is and what it means. That are exposed to other points of view and change their mind. So there's definitely that potential. I don't want to dismiss that possibility as, part of the human experience that people can change in really dramatic ways. And at the same time, I think that's not where we put our energy is to try and convince people who are already like kind of in such a strong opposing camp because there are so many people that are in the like that just haven't, really gotten active on this issue yet, or have seen it as something that's far away that just happens over there and don't really feel like there's anything they can do. And that's where we feel like it's most fruitful to say, let's reach those people, let's engage those people, connect them with our movements. And I think in social movements throughout history, you see that you don't need, every single person involved. It's actually oftentimes it's a small group of people getting really organized and really strategic that has the potential to make a big impact. So we're trying to reach that tipping point. We don't know exactly how it's going to happen, but we're putting, as all of our energy and creativity into trying to reach that point.
We appreciate you taking time out. So, and thank you for, shedding light on that. Jessica, tell people how we can get a hold of you, your last name, where you're at, where you live, what time you get up in the morning, when you what you eat for
Yeah.
breakfast, the whole nine,
Perfect. Yeah, I'm Jessica Anderson. You can find me mostly through Visualizing Palestine. You can reach out to me at jessica@visualizingimpact.org. Always happy to hear ideas of visual stories, especially if you're active on Palestine. What are the tools that you need to do the work that you do, to talk to people about Palestine? So always happy to hear from folks.
Jessica nods. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.